Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and it's great to have you with us wherever you're listening from. Have you got your hands on one of our Book Off tote bags yet? Well, if not, why not check them out on our social media channels where you can find a link to our store and bag yourself one. See what we did there. Remember, too, that we often do book giveaways on our socials, so make sure you're following us on Insta and Twitter and Facebook and all that gubbins if you're so inclined to hear all about our future competition. But now down to business, and it's time to welcome two fabulous authors to the podcast. My first guest is a New York Times bestselling author who has published over 25 novels across 30 countries. Some of her recent books include Behind Her Eyes, now a smash hit Netflix series, and Dead to Her, which is now in development with Amazon Studios, don't you know? Here to tell us about her latest novel, Insomnia, it's Sarah Pimbra. Hello and welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me on this lovely sunny morning.
It's an absolute pleasure, and thank you for joining us. And my second guest read English at Oxford before becoming a journalist, where she spent 11 years at The Guardian before going freelance and writing her first book. Her third novel, Anatomy of a Scandal, was an international bestseller and is soon to be seen on Netflix. Here to talk about her brand new novel, Reputation, it's Sarah Vaughan. Hello to you.
Hello, lovely to be here.
So great to have you both here. Sarah. Not only have you sort of met on Twitter before, but also we met yesterday when we tried to record this. There was a technical fault and we have rescheduled. So this is like, you know, it's like old friends now, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a reunion.
Absolutely. We've bonded over the trauma, haven't we? We've bonded.
Yes, indeed. It's great to have you both here and to talk about these fabulous new novels. And as well as that, we're going to get some reading recommendations from you, and we're going to have the Book Off, of course, where you're each going to pitch us a book that you love, that you think everyone should read, and you'll get 3 minutes uninterrupted to do so a little later on. But let's talk about Insomnia, first of all, Sarah P, if I may. Perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about Emma and then setting up her story and the story of Insomnia for us.
Well, Emma is a woman who, on the surface, has a pretty good life. She's a divorce lawyer. She's got a stay-at-home husband. She's got two children, one 17, one 5. Nice big house, you know, promotion in the offing. But like any woman doing all of those things, there's a lot of peddling under the surface, and she's sort of carrying a lot of the weight in the family, and there's starting to be some fractious stuff going on with her husband. But in the main, she's got a pretty good life. And she's, the book takes place over the 12 days, I think it is, running up to her 40th birthday, during which time she stops sleeping. Hence the title, cunningly named Insomnia. But her mother stopped sleeping in the run-up to her 40th birthday as well, and went mad and did something terrible. And Emma starts to worry that the same thing is happening to her. And it's kind of like my kind of play on those things that women fear, turning 40 and turning into your mother.
Yes. And during one of the many lockdowns across the pandemic, and even now with what's going on in the world. I think a lot of us didn't sleep, aren't sleeping perhaps as much as we used to. We've all experienced probably a little bit of insomnia recently. Was the book born out of an experience like that for you?
Well, I'm not a great sleeper anyway. And Jess, it had an interesting birth, this book, actually, because Jess, who's the producer of Behind Her Eyes, she's not a sleeper either. And me, her and Suzanne Mackey, who was with Left Bank and now has her own production company, they took me away to a posh hotel to brainstorm some TV stuff. And actually, this was what I came up with originally for TV.
Right.
And then when I was coming around playing with the idea, I said to them, look, I want to do this in my next book as well. So then, and this did cause a lot of sleepless nights, I was trying to write the TV and the book at the same time, which I will never try and do again, because obviously you hand in EP1 and then you do notes on EP1 and notes on EP1 again and notes on EP1 again. And then it reached the point where my editor's like, how's that book coming along? I'm like, holy shit. So I said, look, let's park the TV till I've finished the book and then take it from there, because then we will have the whole story and I will have done the book. And so, yeah, so we're now, I think we're just about ready to take it out for TV as well. So it was, but yes, and nobody slept over lockdown. My agents didn't sleep. And it seemed to be much more women, because women were doing more. I mean, Sarah from Netflix has got kids, so she can comment on this as well. But I think women did much more of the heavy lifting with teens and homeschooling and kids and trying to work themselves and the worrying. I think women did more of the heavy lifting with
the emotional load.
The emotional side of it. Yeah. Did you find that, Sarah, with lockdown?
Yeah. I mean, my husband's a doctor, so obviously that had a real level of stress, particularly in the beginning when they had pretty inadequate PPE. And you know, at the very beginning, we all thought everybody was going to die, you know, all doctors were going to die. So obviously that was an element of stress. But the very nature of his job means when he goes to work, you know, we've unfortunately sort of split down this real gender divide. You know, daddy goes out to the office and I'm at home. So obviously all the homeschooling when he wasn't around was me. And just the sort of I worked out that in 18 months that my kids were actually at home with holidays and things and the various different lockdowns, and one did GCSE, so she finished early. They were sort of around for 12 of those 18 months. So what I found really hard was not having the headspace. You know, I mean, just having, you know, my youngest, I was 12, and all the things that have been great for them, like seeing mates and playing sport, were taken away from them. Yeah. And suddenly they were being sent, they're at state school, so they weren't having interactive whizzy Zooms. Certainly in the first lockdown, they were sort of, you know, just being sent links. And it's, frankly, if I hadn't done homeschooling, he would have not done anything. No. Yeah. And you know, it's things like The Tempest, teaching a 12-year-old boy The Tempest. I mean, his English marks were fantastic.
I've been there.
Yeah, you have actually. You've been a teacher, haven't you? So, but, you know, God, Michael Gove. Oh, the curriculum. But that's not, I think the thing is, I found it really hard to be really creative, because I think when you're worrying about people in real life, it's harder to worry about fictional characters. It's like, don't make demands on me, you're not real.
People were saying,
we tried, but it wasn't any good.
Write a novel. I was like, really? I'm sitting here thinking my mum's gonna die if she opens the front door and you want me to write a novel?
Well, exactly. I think the sort of emotional load was quite, and I really, reading your book, which I haven't finished because I do have insomnia around publication, and every time it's 2 o'clock, it's really last,
so
it's 2 a.m. and I'm awake and I'm like, I can't read this is really stressing me out. I really felt for Emma, because she's, even though her husband is this house husband, he's resentful about it, isn't he? And she still ends up being the person who's doing it and sort of going off and doing the shopping because he hasn't done it.
Yeah, it's like all my friends who have high-powered jobs and kids, they even with their husbands who are very good and lovely men, it seems like they're genetically shit at doing the basic
To be fair to my husband, he is really good at cooking and really good. He has one day a week where he's working from home and he does absolutely masses. But I think it's the remembering birthdays and it's the doing all the school admin. It's all that stuff, you know. Yeah. They're sort of the fact that you'll be the person who's called if there's something wrong at school. Because, you know, obviously I'm at home all the time, so obviously I can pop in and do whatever, you know.
Did you find it dynamics with your kids in lockdown affected how you wrote the mother-daughter dynamic in Reputation?
Well, funnily enough, My daughter was, so Reputation has a 14-year-old daughter in it, and my daughter was 14 when I started writing that novel. But I've been very clear that she is not Flora in any way. She thankfully hasn't experienced anything like what Flora experiences. Yes. And they're not actually not, she is not really on social media at all. I mean, they have an Instagram account, which they seem to sort of use to DM mates, you know, instead of tweeting or Snapchatting, but they're just, she's quite savvy, actually, maybe because I've banged on about it so much. And actually in researching this book, having talked to lawyers, I kind of gave them quite a few lectures about precisely what they shouldn't be doing. And they're like, yeah, we've heard all that before. You've written a book about consent. Yeah.
Well, you should probably set up the book for us, Sarah, now that we're talking about it and talking about Flora, because it is a very timely novel, I think. So why don't you just tell us the story in Reputation that you've written?
Oh, okay. So Reputation is about a female Labour MP who stands trial for murder when a tabloid journalist with whom she's become entangled, I think is the way we're putting it, is found in her home. But it's really about the difficulty women face in navigating their way through public life, with themes of harassment, online abuse, revenge porn and political entitlement. And it's also about the difficulties faced by teenage girls through bullying from frenemies on social media. So as we've just said, my MP, Emma Webster, there's an epigraph from the Duchess of Malfi at the start, so she's obviously, it's a element of revenge in here. So Webster's deliberate. Emma Webster's 44, she's a former teacher, and she didn't really intend to become an MP that quickly. She stood in a marginal seat. She thought it would take about three elections so that her then 10-year-old daughter would be, you know, in her late teens, early 20s by the time she became an MP. But the nature of politics is that it's precarious and you can't really tell, as the 2019 election showed us. And so she was elected, and within 6 months her marriage, you know, that was a bit shaky anyway, imploded, and her husband has remarried. There's a second Mrs. Webster, and Flora stays with her dad in the week and then is with her mum at the weekend. And Flora is sort of, I was really conscious that I found my teens really difficult. I was bullied throughout my teens. She really needs her mum. And this isn't casting shade on what her mum Emma does, but by nature of the fact that Emma works in Westminster, does 14 to 16 hour days, is completely preoccupied by an awful lot of stuff that's being thrown at her, she's kind of not that present for Flora, or she kind of assumes Flora's a very sensible teenager and everything's absolutely fine. So they're not quite on the same wavelength. And Flora, just as Emma, as soon as Emma sort of puts her head above the parapet, she starts experiencing all kinds of abuse online and physically, you know, from an angry constituent and through letters and texts. You know, I just kind of threw loads and loads of jeopardy at her. And in a sort of parallel to that, while she's sort of firefighting all of this, Flora's also experiencing issues from former friends online. And I don't know if this is too much of a spoiler, she does something a bit stupid and things spiral from there.
That was perfect, I'd say.
Is that all right? Not too much.
Yeah, lovely little tease. We love that, yeah.
Good at teasing.
There's a, talking about a mother and daughter relationship, Sarah P, there's a mother and daughter relationship in your new book. Emma's relationship, your character Emma's relationship with her mother, and Phoebe's relationship with her mother, because they're sisters, important part of the story. But I really thought the sort of different perspectives were quite interesting,
right,
the way you wrote them.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think the way we view our parents and how things change as we get older, and perspective and all that stuff, and what's truth to you when you're seven is not truth when you're 35, which isn't truth when you're 50. You know, your perspective on events can be very different. So, you know, Phoebe is much more forgiving. She's decided, or so it would appear, you know, I'm not, you know, whether she is or not, we will find out. She appears much more sympathetic to... So her mother, with Emma, and this isn't giving anything away from the story, Emma's mother does a terrible thing. And then she is in an institution. She's kind of vegetative, not from any injury per se, she's just totally closed down. And then when at the start of the book she is in hospital because she has been found sort of bashing her head against a mirror, and this brings Phoebe back, and Phoebe rings Emma, and so it brings the past very much into Emma's present. And Emma hasn't told her, as far as Emma's family, as in her immediate family, are concerned, their mother died when Emma was little. She didn't tell them any of this sort of backstory. So she's kind of juggling everything. But I think she's got her own relationship with her own teenage daughter, which is troubled. You know, Chloe's definitely doing stupid teenage things, and Emma's very protective. And then she has her own relationship with her mother to sort of unravel and examine. So it all kind of interweaves together. But I am quite interested, you know, when you look back at whatever your relationship with your mum is like, and most women have tricky relationships with their mothers, and I don't know why, because this is a person who births you and you're kind of totally dependent on and is the centre of your world till you're about 12, really. Mm. And then, you know, it's the person you probably resent the most as years go on, as you grow up, weirdly. You know, dad's always a bit more remote. But then I look back at things like, I think, God, when I was 8, I was at school in Syria. So this was, you know, I'm old, so it was pre-internet, pre-mobile phone, pre-technology. And, you know, my mum would just crack on and get down the souk and buy food and sift bugs out of flour. And, you know, like, and you kind of think, that, so she would have been maybe 36, 37 then. And I would have been like, no Uber, no Deliveroo, what's going on?
Exactly. You know?
So you do change your perspectives on things, and time, you get older and maybe wiser, or maybe just more curious about people. So sorry, I just went on a middle-aged ramble there, didn't I?
Love it. No, absolutely right. And one last thing on Insomnia, if I may, which is about its sort of, its form, because I think I told you before, when last year when I first got my very early proof, very exciting, you know, I was told this is a genre-bending novel, and I thought, ooh, but that's what Sarah Pimbra does. And I just wondered if you approach books knowing you're going to do that, or if you just start writing and let it go wherever it wants to go.
Not always. I mean, I come from a very paranormal background, as it were. You know, my first 6 books were horror, then I wrote fairy tales, I've written historical crime horror, I've written dystopian horror, you know, like, so I've written a lot of weird stuff. But I mean, Cross a Heart was a straight novel, you know, there was no weird in it. Dead Tail's got the slightest little twinges of it in there, but with this one it was more, actually, there was what I tend to do approaching a story, and I think this comes because I do work quite a lot in TV and film stuff now, and it comes very much from when you come up with a pitch idea and you think, yeah, this is solid, this works. And then I think, can I flip it? So I always come to, what can I flip in this? What can I flip? So that's, and often, because I'll maybe have some weird, I like, you know, like with Behind Her Eyes, I wanted to write about dreams, and then the rest kind of came from there. So I kind of then muck around, and then I get the ending. And once I've got the ending locked in place, then I can do the rest. So I don't, long and short of it is, this one did not start out supernatural, and then I had a moment of, oh, actually, this would be much more interesting if.
Right.
But I try and seed it so that it plays like a thriller. So it's the clues are there, it's all seeded in. So it's not like a ghost story where the mystery is second to the haunting. The supernatural should, like in Behind Her Eyes, it's the backbone of the story.
Yes.
The whole thriller is based around that. So it has to be there, kind of hinted at from very early on in the book, I think.
Mm. Yeah. And you mentioned working quite a lot in TV now, Sarah, and Sarah V, Anatomy of a Scandal, is coming to Netflix. In fact, very soon, isn't it? 15th of April, something like that?
15th of April, which is Good Friday. So I think they hope that people will binge it
over weekend,
Easter weekend.
Yeah.
So, and each episode is about 40 minutes long. So I think, and there are 6 of them. So I think actually sometimes an hour long episode can feel, if it hasn't got breaks,
it's the perfect
too long.
Click.
It's a perfect click. Binginess. Yeah.
Great. And how involved have you been?
Well, I'm not such a TV mogul as the other Sarah, but I do feel like I was. Well, I'm an executive producer,
which I'll take that.
I think it can. I think it can be quite a vanity thing. I think it can be that it's just you take the money and it's, you know, your name's on the credits.
Right.
But I don't know whether it's because I'm a bit of a control freak or just because I felt so. Anatomy's about consent and power and privilege and entitlement, and. I just was very concerned, I suppose. I wasn't very concerned. When I was really lucky, I had various different people who were interested in optioning it. And I went with this amazing team of 2 women, Bruna Papandrea of Made Up Stories and Liza Chasen of 3 Productions. And Bruna with and David E. Kelly as well. And Bruna and David had already done Big Little Lies, and they've now done The Undoing and Nine Perfect Strangers, and Bruna had done Gone Girl. So I kind of, and when they talked to me, I was really, really aware that they wanted to put women behind the camera, women in front of the camera. So we've got a female director, S.J. Clarkson, who's done Jessica Jones and a bit of Succession, and she's absolutely brilliant. She absolutely, I think she's really amazing, and she really got it. You know, we talked a lot, and I'm not answering very, very, how was I involved? I gave notes on different scripts, and I gave notes on five different versions of five different drafts. It's really faithful to the tone of the book. It's really nuanced. I think it'll be really thought provoking. It feels very faithful to the book. I think they probably would have brought this in anyway, but I was quite emphatic they probably needed a legal consultant, because I was really concerned that the court scenes were very, very adhered to the book. And I also checked things with political contacts. And I think because, I mean, obviously amazing people working on the scripts, David E. Kelly, who did Big Little Lies and did Ally McBeal years ago. And he'd done Law at Boston, you know, he's about 60, I think, he'd done Law at Boston years ago. And Melissa James Gibson, who worked on House of Cards. But obviously they're both American, and it's filmed in London, and it's very English or very British. And so I think it probably helped as well, having me being very English and sort of just picking up on idioms and things like that, you know, so I hope that helped. And they obviously they mentioned who they were approaching, and I squealed embarrassingly, and you know, but I mean,
couldn't play that one cool.
Couldn't play that call at all. And then because of COVID, I only managed to go on set towards the end of the third lockdown, and I had to have two PCR tests to do that. And then when I've gone and watched Rough Cuts, which has been fine, but it was just brilliant going on set and seeing it all come together. And, yeah.
And who's in it?
Sienna Miller is Sophie. Have I not gone on about that? Are you not aware of that? No, Sienna Miller's got Sophie. Michelle Dockery is Kate. Would you like to see some photos? There is James Whitehouse in the dock.
He's looking very guilty. I'm not going to say anything. But he's looking
dodgy. Well, I'm not saying anything because I'm not creating spoilers. Right, so what I will say is they've made fantastic use of his cheekbones with the cinematography. Oh. They have really got Rupert's and money worth of Rupert's cheekbones. I'm a real sucker for cheekbones. And Sienna just looks amazing in it. But more importantly, apart from it looking sumptuous and fantastic, and they had a set, two stages, is that what they called it, at Shepperton? But they did a lot on location. So they filmed in Oxford for a week, in Winchester, in Manchester, and then in central London, absolutely masses, including inside the Bailey and outside the House of Commons. And then they kind of spliced together lots of sort of central London historic locations, you know. It looks amazing. And I mean, I'm clearly not the most objective person about it, but Michelle Dockery made me cry, and I think Sienna's performance is the best thing I've seen her do. I think she's absolutely brilliant in it, and it's and I hope that it will, yeah, people will binge it and they'll love the locations and the clothes and how it looks. But I also really hope, without wanting to be too earnest, that it'll make people think a bit and promote a bit of discussion. So we went out for dinner after we watched the first four episodes, and we just went on and on about, you know, would the jury find him guilty? What would, you know, what do we think of this? And also I think different generations might have different responses, without wanting to give away too much of a spoiler. There's a kind of Oxford backstory from sort of mid-90s. And so there's a young team of actors who've been involved as well, literally straight out of drama school, some of them. And I think they probably might have different takes. Or my kids, you know, my daughter would probably have a different take. So it'd be really interesting to watch, hopefully. And I'm ridiculously excited. I'm going to be like Sarah said, isn't there some tracker or something you can work out whether it's...
Yes, Flix Patrol.
I'm going to do no work. I'm going to be on that all the time. Yeah,
refresh that over and over and over.
So we're excited for that then, Sarah, for, well, what will be Easter weekend. So the perfect thing to binge over Easter weekend on Netflix. And Sarah P, you've had a show on Netflix already, and I'm right in thinking, aren't I, that Dead to Her is being adapted at the moment, but this is with Amazon. Any news there?
Well, we're edging towards the glorious green light. I read the pilot, which was brilliant. I like what they've changed. It's, you know, it's dark, it's funny. It's being adapted by Tracy White Oliver, who is the first black woman to make a million at the box office. And she's done loads of films and TV. And I think they're now doing episode 2, and then I think we should be greenlit after that, all going well. So that's exciting. And I'm doing Death House with the people who produced Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, great. So,
yeah, fun. I've killed those children a lot of times now. It's very South Park. Yes. Like, oh, I'm going to take
back again.
Okay. Here we go again. I mean, it's just like, it's, people always say, like, about screenwriting and books, and they make this mistake. They say, oh, it's much quicker to write a script than a book. And you think, it's much quicker to write draft one of a script than a book. But by the time you hit, you know, like, I spent most of last year in different writers' rooms for shows, and you're on, like, you always go back to draft 2, but you could be on draft 9 by the time you go back to draft 2 and rewrite. You know, it's just like you're constantly, because the more people it goes, the higher, you know, it goes to the broadcaster, it goes to the producers, it goes to this, it goes to that, and then there's more notes and more notes, and then episode 3 changes, so episode 2 changes. So it's like, there's, you know, it takes a lot longer to do TV than it does a book. I call it the difference between a marriage and an affair. So a marriage is your book, because it takes its time, it builds, it's steady, it's reliable, it's all yours, you know, you get there in the end. You know, when you're writing a script, it's full on passion and fury for 14 days, and then you just can't get rid of the thing.
Like, I love that. Like,
you can't get rid of it. It's like, keeps coming back, and you're like, oh God, just you could go away now.
We've had our fun now. Just
I've forgotten why
down.
I liked you. I forgot why I liked you. I want to go back to my book, my lovely book that loves me.
Well, we await to hear then about more developments for Dead to Her, and we're excited about that too. I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently, and that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they've been reading and enjoying something that's brand new, just something that, you know, they've picked up and enjoyed and want to sort of shout about. Have you found time, Sarah V, to be reading much, and have you got anything that you want to recommend to us quickly?
Well, I've just had COVID, which meant that I think for the first time since my children were born, I actually lay in bed and I couldn't, you know, because I was sort of self-isolating and I was quite wiped out with it. So I read a lot more slowly than I wanted to. The book I was going to pitch to you, I realised I couldn't remember anything about, so I reread all of that. So you've got a good pitch. And I also reread... Gone Girl, because again I've got an awful memory for, you know, I know about the twist, you know, that I'd read, but I must have read Gone Girl, you know, when it came out. So I reread that to really look at the structure, and I loved it, and it was, you know, sharp. And also what I really and I'd forgotten quite how complex it was, the sort of treasure hunt. And what I also loved about it was Amy's cool girl speech, which I think is worth reading just for that, as sort of diatribe against, you know, the sort of assumptions that men make about women, cool girl women, and, you know, girls play into. But I also read Harriet Tice's It Ends at Midnight, which is coming out in April. It's coming out next month, isn't it?
It is. Which she's going to be on this very podcast, Sarah.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I said it was more Blood Orange than Blood Orange. It was more Divorce than Blood Orange. The sort of similarly self-loathing, drunken, unreliable narrator. But, yeah, I thought I'd actually gone up to Edinburgh in... it's partly set in Edinburgh and Gillane Beach. And because of an Airbnb cock-up, we ended up staying in Gillane, which I'd never been to before.
Really?
So I'd been on the beach where the party was. And clearly she had much more debauched teens than I did.
Hey, I was calling Harriet. I'm saying nothing.
Are you? Wow. Okay.
It was quite interesting because so much of it was like our youth was tangled.
Really? Oh, well. And we also stayed in Edinburgh. So I could imagine those spiked railings and I hadn't been to Edinburgh for years and in Newtown and where it might have happened. So that was fun reading that. And before that, I'd read Idol, which Louise O'Neill's Idol, which I think is coming out in... May, maybe.
May, I think, yeah.
Yeah, which is really interesting as well about social media and consent. And I think she and I kind of skirt around similar themes, actually. So I think that's really interesting. And it's about a sort of, it's got a terrific opening chapter with a sort of this sort of social media. You know, she has sort of, she's an influencer. And yeah. She's just got these sort of teenage girls who are desperate to latch onto someone to adore who they think is going to give them all these sort of answers and things. And it's just very clever. So I thought that was really good as well. So yeah, that's what, so I've been reading Things Coming Up, It Ends Up in Night, and Idle. And I've got a pile of stuff that the new Ruth Wears just arrived yesterday. So when I finished Insomnia, which now, hopefully, now we've done this podcast, I'll be able to sleep now. And I'll be able to finish the book. I'm about three quarters of the way through. So I'm, yeah.
Nearly there.
Just need to read it in the day. And then,
Fab recommendations. Thank you very much. What about you, Sarah P? What have you been reading and enjoying?
I read Jenny Fagan before, but I've really become a massive fan of Jenny Fagan. So her Luck and Booth was brilliant. Mm. And I just read Hex, which is a novella, really. But she just writes this beautiful kind of magical prose. And it's about a woman in Edinburgh in jail in the 17th century who's going to get hung as a witch the next day, killed as a witch the next day, a young girl. Mm. And it's about a woman in the present time visiting her in her jail cell in the form of crow. And it's again, it's about men and women and, you know, the unfairness and the, you know, how this poor girl is ending up being hung. But she's just such a beautiful writer without being pretentious about it, which is a very hard line. It's like some people, you can read some people's work and I feel like they're really trying to be literary writers, and some people just are literary writers, and she just is a literary writer. You never feel like it's labored. It's just really beautiful writing without feeling like you're wading through it to get to the story, you know, like you don't feel like they're kind of masturbating as they write, which you kind of get with some, you know. I also read, speaking of great writers, Catriona Ward's Sundial, which I really enjoyed. I did an event with her the other night for America, and it's very, we've got quite a lot of thematic similarities. I've known Kat for, you know, since her first book came out, and she's been long overdue, I think, to get the success that Needless Street had. I read, and it was great fun. It was Paul Cleave's The Quiet People.
Oh, yeah.
Which came out from Arenda. And I love Paul. He's a deadpan, very funny man. And I mean, I first met him the weekend his mother died. He came to Harrogate. And his mother died while he was flying over. So he just was like, well, I might as well carry on.
Oh, gosh.
But he was, it was just so odd, because actually we had such a fun weekend, because he's such a deadpan person that obviously he was having all this emotional stuff, but he was practicing his speech for his mother. Anyway, his dark humour is very present in this thriller, and it's about two authors, which is always fun to read as an author, who are married, and they're kind of like, is it Nikki French, which is a married couple? They're kind of like,
it is, yeah.
Right, as a married couple, and their child goes missing, and it kind of, you get this unravelling of everything around them and their marriage, and, you know, who blames who for what, and who's, you know, a bit Gone Girly with a missing child.
Yeah.
And I actually, it was interesting, because I'd read Hex and Sundial, which I absolutely loved and were beautiful, and then I raced through Quiet People, and it was just a really solid, I mean, his writing's good, you know, but it wasn't literary, you know, like, I know people get really funny about literary writing, but I do believe there is a genre of literary writing, and he's a solid thriller writer, and I absolutely loved it. It was a real kind of fun read. I'm currently reading the new Callie Taylor one, which comes out, I think, in May. Mm-hmm. But I've got a stack. I've got the new Ruth Wears come as well, so I'm looking forward to that one. But I'm kind of, I'm doing something slightly different with my next book. So I'm actually enjoying reading psychological thrillers more, because I'm not thinking, oh, you know, like I remember reading Lucy Foley when I was having a bit of an emotional crisis about books and thinking maybe I need to write and 8 people stuck in a remote location.
Yeah, I just tried to do that. Yeah.
And then I just, everybody's doing that. Everybody had the same panic.
Yeah, we were saying,
however, actually, I'm going to furrow my own little shallow path, and if it fails, it fails. But, you know.
It won't fail. Not at all.
I should say, I was also thinking, what else had I been reading? And I'm sure you might have heard of this one. In fact, I think she's been on, or she's on this series, again, Rachel. And to my shame, I hadn't read Rachel's, or I can't remember. I can't remember books I've read in the past. I couldn't remember reading
Rachel's.
Well,
it was Rachel's 25 years ago.
Well, I've not read it. Is it? Are they good?
I think when Rachel's Holiday came out, I was 23, 24, just started my... 24 I must have been. Stop denying my age, Sarah. But I think I just started as a journalist in London. I wasn't doing the coke, but I was probably being a bit like Rachel, you know, and I'd come out of doing an English degree where you didn't have to read anything after 1832. I think I read magazines and newspapers, but I just had a bit of a period when I didn't, and I read French literature for some bizarre reason, but I wasn't reading commercial literature. So I hadn't read it. So I read it before I then read again Rachel, and I just think she's so, I mean, everyone says this, that she's a genius because she makes you cry, and there's a real depth beneath the wit and the, you know, and the gorgeous voice. As you're reading it, it's like she's reading you a story. And I was reading it, and then I was doing the washing up, and I put on BBC Sounds, and she was doing she was doing some podcast, you know, and I heard her voice on it. It's just like she's reading you the most gorgeous story, but there's so much pain in it as well, but it's sort of lightly done, but it really has impact. I just think she's so supportive as well of up and coming authors. I just think she's a generous woman. Yeah, I just think she's a really lovely woman. But the book, I thought, again, Rachel was actually better than Rachel's Holiday, which in a way you'd hope, wouldn't you, after 25 years? I just thought that was real. There were phrases that will stick with me that I'll never see a kind of middle class man without thinking green and black man, you know, about the chocolate, you know, and there are just really little witty bits, but beneath that, and you know, I sort of effectively fell in love with her ridiculous leather trousered Luke Costello, but you know, it's quite sexy, but it's I just thought she's so clever, and it's beautifully constructed as well, and
really great.
Yeah, if I'd known I was having COVID, I should have saved that, and that would have been a perfect thing to cheer me up, but also to make me blub when I was ill. But
no, you're right, that's it's sort of a perfect COVID novel, if that's a way of phrasing it, but I mean that as a compliment. And you're right, Sarah, Marion was on with the wonderful Nina Stibbe on this very series, so there is a previous episode with them both, and they are fabulous, and they are very supportive of each other to the point of both embarrassing each other. Thank you very much for those recommendations.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And now it's time for another one, because it's time for The Book Off, where each of you is going to tell us about a book you love that you think me and the listeners should all read. And you get 3 minutes uninterrupted. You don't have to use the 3 minutes if you don't want to, but if you're still talking at the 3 minute mark, you're either going to be honked out by the bicycle horn or rung out by the school bell. So Sarah P, would you like to be rung out or honked out at your 3-minute mark?
I would like to be honked, please.
You'd like the honk. Okay, no problem. And Sarah V, would you like to go first or do you want to see what Sarah P's got and then go second?
Oh, God. I think I might get it out of the way. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Get it out of the way. I love it. Just before we set the timer going, tell us the book that you're putting forward.
Well, I was going to show it to you, but then I realise it's not a Zoom, so that doesn't work. Oh, God. It's Hilary Mantel's Bring Out the Bodies.
Fantastic. All right. 3 minutes then. Over to you, uninterrupted, to tell us about Bring Out the Bodies.
Okay. The book I'm choosing is Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies. It doesn't need much of an introduction. The middle instalment of her Cromwell trilogy, it won the 2012 Man Booker Prize and the 2012 Costa Prize, making her the only author ever to have won both awards in the same year. It's the most accessible of the trilogy. Wolf Hall seems slightly more literary, while The Mirror and the Light is a little more formidable in length, almost as if she was delaying the inevitable Cromwell's death. Bring Up the Bodies, shorthand for Bring Up the Individuals Who'll Be Executed, should be read by everyone because it's a terrific portrait of a powerful, mercurial leader and the hoops those around him have to jump through to ensure their political and literal survival at court. It's exquisitely written, it's immersive, and bizarrely for a novel which, as anyone with any knowledge of English history knows, ends with Anne Boleyn's beheading, it's genuinely suspenseful. It's the paciest of the three books and you want to keep on reading, aware that Anne will be killed at the end but intrigued as to precisely how Cromwell ensures this happens, because the stakes are high for Master Secretary. If he doesn't bring this about, he knows it'll be his head on a spike outside the tower. Bring Up the Bodies is about politics, but it's also about sex and death. Like any good soap opera, it's really about who Henry wants to bed. Catherine of Aragon dies, Anne Boleyn miscarries a boy at 5 months, and Henry wants to move on to the great James Seymour. The need to provide a male heir is imperative, but he's also tired of hard and glittering Anne and wants meek, plain, refreshingly stupid Jane. In a world in which the Queen should be more modest, more humble, more discreet, more obedient than an ordinary woman, Anne is contrary, flirtatious, and has forged an alternative court. Henry wonders if he was dishonestly led into this marriage, and so Cromwell starts to take tea with her ladies-in-waiting, providing cake and the chance for a gossip. Soon he has a list of 5 potential lovers to prosecute on trumped-up charges, including George, her brother. The bishops will be frigging themselves, he predicts, but just in case incest and adultery are insufficient, charges of treason are lobbed in. Writers should read Bring Up the Bodies to learn from Mantel's technical skill. She's a master of closed third-person present tense consciousness. Cromwell's charisma never has room to dissipate because for most of the 1,932 pages in total in the whole trilogy, you're firmly inside his head. And what a head it is. Cromwell has modern sensibilities. He wants to tax the rich, introduce benefits for the poor, put an English, not Latin, Bible in every church. He's slyly funny about the aristocrats jostling for position, and he's a very human, engaging man, full of love for his teenage son Gregory, still experiencing moments of grief for his late son and late wife and daughters, but not averse to bedding a pub landlady and imagining sex with Jane Seymour's older sister Bess. But it's in his handling of Henry VIII that he's the most mesmeric. He understands that the volatile, childish king, like our Prime Minister or Donald Trump, needs to be liked and doesn't want to make tough decisions. After all, he has Thomas Cromwell for that. So Cromwell is always thinking ahead, assessing who he can implicate even if they're not necessarily guilty. Watching his back too, because in a novel about class, in which class is a major theme, his critics always see him as Putney Blacksmith's son. When Henry turns on him and derides him for this, the situation is perilous. He will never claim that his heart did not turn over. Henry could at any moment gesture his to his guards. He could find himself a cold metal at his ribs and his day is done.
Fantastic.
I had to miss 2 sentences at the end. I was like, shit, I can't get there. I can't say my final line.
Well okay. Done. You, beat. That was very...
I just had a flashback to
have
school.
You?
And I remember this takes me back to being in A-level bloody history. We had to be tame in and we had to do a timed essay, and obviously like he threw it on us. I was nowhere near prepared for this, and then when we got them back, like everyone else was getting their A's and B's, and he got to me and he said, Sarah, very well written essay.
Ooh.
Beautifully expressed. And I was thinking, oh, I'm in there. And then he went, literally no factual content whatsoever. E. And now I'm literally about to win this. I've got a little bit of notes and a lot of waffle.
You can.
I'm like,
you'll
that's
be
all
doing
you need.
It.
That's all you need, Sarah.
Yeah, but you've been much better in the interview. That's fine. It's fine. You've got it on the interview. The only reason I did this, and I still have not got my killer final line, which I've not managed to get in. But anyway, I was so concerned I was going to be honked out and then go, oh, I got the honk or whatever. Whatever. I listened. I made the mistake. First of all, I listened to it with Imran Mamoon and Robert Peston, where they basically, because they're both professional wingers, aren't they? So they basically can just talk off the hoof. So it was a real blokey thing where, you know, the top barrister and the top political journalist could just do it off the hoof. And then I made the mistake of listening to Ashley Audrain and Abigail Dean and Jodie Picou. And both of whom had Jodie Picou's was like a rap because she spoke so fast. Yeah. So I slowed up, which is why I didn't get my last two sentences
Listen, Sarah, all you need to remember from this is you're not selling your own book here.
That's true. That's what I'm doing wrong. That's why I'm
lovely, brilliant. But at the end of the day, if I mess this up, it's like, well, poor Joanna Cannon. That's all I'm going to say.
So I failed to sell my own book very well, but I managed to sell Hillary's, and she doesn't really need it. But anyway,
probably doesn't need it, but still a very good job all round. But yeah.
Do you think I can send my essay to her? Do you think she'll give me an essay?
I think she'd like that. Yeah, I think you should definitely send it over. We'll send her this episode as well for her to listen.
Fine, there you go. Yeah.
Well done, though, Sarah V. That was brilliant, and you can have a little breather and a rest now. And I'm going to put 3 minutes back on the clock just before we start it. Sarah P, tell us you've already teased us there, Joanna Cannon. Which novel are you putting forward?
I apologise to Joe before I even start, but the book is called A Tidy Ending and it comes out on the 28th of April.
Fantastic. All right, so brand new. Oh, no. 3 minutes on the clock then. Over to you, Sarah, to tell us about A Tidy Ending.
Okay, well, this is a real quirky joy of a book to read. And I think that given the state of the world at the moment, everyone needs a book they can just lose themselves in, smile, get carried away with it. And I read it, I picked it up and scanned the first paragraph and thought, you know, is this going to be any good? And literally I'd read it in two sittings after that. And it was my first Jo Cannon book because I always thought she was going to be too literary for me. And it's taught me what all the fuss is about with her, because the writing is amazing. It's filled with some wonderful observations, which I would have read out a couple, but I gave the proof away as soon as I finished the book. But it also has a brilliant plot and an amazing central character who have stayed with me. And I am going to read the book again when it comes out. So it's about a 43-year-old woman called Linda, who is one of life's underdogs, who lives a quiet and old-fashioned sort of life. She helps out in a charity shop where she's fixated on the young female manager. She thinks they're best friends. The woman clearly finds Linda very disconcerting. She has a husband called Terry, and they've just moved into a new house, but kind of live separate lives, not in a we're about to break up way, but just in a that's how life turns out way. And she also has a very domineering mother who lives nearby, and they see each other once a week. And from their dynamic, you can tell that something bad happened in their past with Linda's dad. And it's clearly shaped and scarred, you know, their life and relationship. So Linda's in her new house and she's starting to wonder if this is all there is, hoovering, cooking, etc. And post arrives for the previous owner called Rebecca. So again, there's a little allusion there. And she gets these home furnishing magazines that Linda starts to pore over, and they're all glamorous and exciting. She starts to think if she can track Rebecca down and make friends with her, then some of Rebecca's glamour will rub off on her and she'll be a more perfect person and, you know, have lots of friends and all this stuff. And alongside this, a serial killer has started to kill women on their estate, and it's very curtain twitchy and gossipy. And Linda, who has a history, it transpires, of trying to insert herself into police investigations, which is very funny, starts to suspect her husband. So as she tracks down Rebecca and is also investigating these murders and has all this issue with her mom and the shop and all this stuff, everything starts to weave together really, really cleverly and very surprisingly. And by the end, I had to smile at the ingenuity. I wanted to applaud Linda, even though, you know, she's very unreliable. It's like a much darker Eleanor Oliphant, with beautiful, beautiful writing, incredible characters. It's a really good lose yourself in it for a couple of hours. You know, I read it so quickly and it's a big book, and everyone should buy it next month when it comes out. And I'm going to go and read all her other books because it was just brought me joy, which in these dark times, I think we all need. And I'm out.
Way.
Oh, perfect timing.
Oh, that's unbelievable. Well done. No prep, and you bring it in right on time. Well done.
That's very classy.
Yeah, I was winging it, but note-wise.
I loved both of those. Thank you so much. Bring Up the Bodies is my dad's favourite of the trilogy as well, Sarah. And it is the most accessible, I think. You're right. And when you were sort of talking about it, it reminded me that, yes, actually, that's the one you can sort of really, well, speed through, although it's still pretty big. You know, that is the one that sort of really does allow you to race through it.
I think the first one, she has this slightly weird he Cromwell that she uses an awful lot and really, really long sentences where you can kind of get lost in who all the characters are and all the sort of stream of consciousness of it. Whereas I think she's got rid of that and the sentences are a bit blunter. And also it's, you know, there are these big personalities. So, you know, and it's really funny. And the final one, although it's beautifully written, it almost feels as if, I think she said she delayed, she couldn't finish it because she didn't want to kill him off. And it, you know, it's something like 850 pages.
Yeah, it's long.
It probably could have done
and it is a bit, the third one I find, sometimes you're like, hang on, wait, who's saying that? What?
Who's Brandon? Who's Suffolk?
Yeah.
Whereas this, like you said, together. Sorry.
This one's exquisitely written, as you put it, Sarah, and I agree. Genuinely suspenseful as well. Yes, it is. How? Because we sort of, well, most people know what is actually going to happen in it. But my favourite part of your pitch was that, you know, writers should read it to learn from her craft, which I think is fabulous. And you're so right about the writing of it. And it is a cracking book. And Jo Cannon is wonderful. I have had the pleasure of interviewing her before and reading previous books, Sarah. A Tidy Ending is, as you say, coming out soon. And she's going to be on this very podcast talking about it. And I do think you're right. We need a bit of quirk and joy, don't we, at the moment, with the state of the world? We need to be smiling.
Sometimes what can be perceived as smaller lives have so much going on in them. And I think that was what was so fascinating. We, you know, so many of our, and I speak as my writing too, and Sarah's, I think, our characters have very nice lives and they, you know, bad things are happening to them, but they're, you know, they're having these nice lives and nice things are happening. You know, they've got a nice car, they've got a nice house. And this, she's, you know, she's a very, from the outside, clearly socially awkward, but a very normal day-to-day humdrum existence woman whose husband has a, you know, a blue collar job, and which it seems to be people don't write about so much unless they're doing it in a very worthy way, you know, whereas she's done it. And actually, there's nothing dumb about Linda. You know, it's a really smart book.
Just a real slice of life as well.
And and her observations. I mean, it was a lesson to me in that I remember when Trouble with Goats and Sheep came out, and I remember thinking, oh, that sounds interesting, but then thinking, oh, I don't think it's for me. It was one of those lessons that often, when I was younger, I read so much more widely. And I think when you start to write, especially, and Sarah will know this, you get sent a lot of proofs, and then you feel this moral obligation to read the proofs. So you're reading the same, like my mum, I used to give the proofs to my mum. And she would read them. She'd go, God, so many books are psychological thrillers these days. I'm like, no, they're just the ones. You know, like, they're not all psychological. And I found it's very interesting to look at the bestsellers list at the moment, because I think psych thrillers have maybe glutted out a little, and people are a bit like, okay, so it's either her husband or her best friend or her wife. I mean, I'm saying this with one coming out in 2 weeks, but, you know, I think there is a scope for more interesting, varied, doesn't have to, if people want to try their hand at other things. Yeah. My new thing is, you know, at lockdown, I took stock and I thought, you know, I wrote 22 books before Behind Her Eyes and had a good career, but Behind Her Eyes was the big one. And I thought, you know what? I own my own home. I've got money in the bank. I could retire tomorrow. It's not a problem. If I'm going to keep writing, I want to write the stories that interest me. And if they're not Times bestsellers, they're not Times bestsellers. If they are, they are. So this is my new track, is I'm sort of being much more, it's a pain in the ass for my agents and editors, but, you know, my next one will be a slight change of direction from this one.
Yeah. And it's so great that you've read this one and now are going to go back and read other Jo Cannons,
yeah,
I think. And
totally.
I loved your description at Darker Eleanor Oliphant, which I think is a perfect description for this. So
I've used that twice, this book and also Will Carver's Psychopaths Anonymous, which is another joy to read, darker than this one, but that's very much a Dark Eleanor Oliphant. Yeah.
Well, two fabulous pictures, I have to say, and two brilliant books. And, you know, you've sold them both very well, but do you know what? I'm going to take Jo Cannon on this occasion, I think. Sarah P. wins
it. It's not out yet. So it's like, let's get the book that's not out yet.
Now, that's for two reasons. One, as Sarah V. said, you know, I don't think Hillary needs our support. But the other thing is, Jo's coming on the podcast in a few weeks, so I want to be able to tell her that she won.
She won the
Well, I won't do my girly SWAT essay next time.
A very good pitch. No, they were both brilliant. So, you know, and I think if anyone hasn't read Hilary Mantel and they want something to get their teeth into, then it is, you know, obviously a fabulous trilogy. And that is the one.
And also, another lesson in don't think it's too literary. You know, like,
exactly.
Yeah. Another one. I did the same thing with that too. I was like, that looks a bit weighty for me, and then really enjoyed it. So, you know.
Exactly.
But also a lesson in not just reading the psychological thriller proof that you're sent, which I do far too much of. Because actually, you know, no offence to that. But, you know, as you say, you do start to think, oh, second chapter, well, it's the husband, or, you know.
Yeah. Well, you definitely resold it to me. So you have.
Too late
honestly.
Now.
Too late, but, you know. That's, I'm,
can't take it back.
No, I didn't get the honk or the award.
And Reputation by Sarah Vaughan is out now. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And look out for Anatomy of a Scandal on Netflix coming 15th of April. And Insomnia by Sarah Pimrer is also out now, published by HarperCollins. And it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you both, having your recommendations, spending this time with you. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you for your brilliant book recommendations. And best of luck with the TV adaptations to come.
Oh, thank you. Lovely to meet you. Lovely to just be here.
Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.